Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Susan Yawkey reporting. Iraq Parliament collapses. Baghdad teetered on the edge of political chaos today. The city is in a state of emergency. Protesters are occupying parts of the once secure international zone. Lawmakers have run away, and the military is on high alert. Correspondent Sharon Bain in Erbil, Iraq, says there have been weeks of protests.
There is a massive swelling, a groundswell among the population of grievance against the government. They find it completely corrupt, and they're lacking basic services. And there has been a groundswell of opposition to the government because they failed to reform the system. In his defense, Prime Minister Abadi has said that he has not been able to reform it because the political blocks inside parliament.
Correspondent Sharon Bain in Erbil, Iraq. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is due late today in Geneva as part of a U.S. bid to reaffirm a U.S.-Russian mediated ceasefire as violence escalates in Syria, especially in its largest city, Aleppo. The secretary made clear that ending the violence in Aleppo and returning ultimately to a durable nationwide cessation is a top priority. State Department spokesman John Kirby said before the top U.S. diplomat departed Washington. Meanwhile, Russian General Sergei Kurilenko told Russian news agencies talks are underway to halt the Syrian bombardment of the rebel stronghold in Aleppo. To support the ceasefire, the Syrian military on Friday said it would impose a temporary regime of calm in the areas around Damascus and northwestern Syria's Latakia province. But the order did not include Aleppo. We invite you to visit our website at voanews.com. This is VOA News. A car bomb explosion outside police headquarters in the southeastern Turkish city of Gaziantep has killed at least two police officers and wounded at least 22 other people, a local governor said. Turkish media quoted Gaziantep regional governor Ali Yerlikaya as saying many of those wounded in today's blast are police officers. Militant group Al-Shabaab attacked and recaptured a town in Somalia's middle Shabelle region early today, killing 22 Somali soldiers, an official told VOA on condition of anonymity. The militants claimed that they had killed more than 32 soldiers, including a senior military officer in the town of Runargood, day after the town had fallen to government forces. The commander of Somalia's 12th sector, Mohamed Mohamud Sane, told VOA his soldiers were ambushed and eight of them were killed, while his forces killed 12 al-Shabaab militants. The commander said a senior officer was wounded and is now missing. To send a message to the world that ivory is worth more on an elephant than it is in the market, Kenya's president set fire to the country's ivory stockpile, making it the largest ivory burn in history. VOA's Jill Craig was there.
Plumes of smoke filled the air of a muddy Nairobi National Park as Kenya's President Kenyatta presided over the burning of 105 tons of elephant ivory as well as 1.35 tons of rhino horn.
The height of the pile of ivory before us marks the strength of our resolve. Before you, ladies and gentlemen, is the largest haul of ivory and horn ever to be destroyed in this manner.
Critics have argued that poor countries like Kenya should sell the ivory to improve the lives of their people. The Kenya Wildlife Service has responded that selling these illegal trophies dramatically increases elephant poaching, threatening the animal's very existence. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Father Daniel Berrigan has died. He was 94 years old. Berrigan, an activist American Jesuit priest, a pacifist, and a poet, is best remembered as the radical leftist priest who burned draft records to protest the Vietnam War. Berrigan, his brother Philip, also a priest, and seven other activists, walked into the offices of the local draft board in 1968 in Catonsville, Maryland. They took the selective service files of young men being sent to Vietnam. And U.S. President Barack Obama was the main attraction as journalists, politicians, and celebrities attended the annual White House Correspondents' Dinner Saturday night here in Washington. It was a chance for Obama to poke fun one last time at himself as well as his friends, enemies, the media, and Congress, and anybody else in his way. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
The entire country is clamoring for her return onto the political landscape. To give to Ghanaians what she had done and knows best.
A Ghanaian opposition party endorses a former first lady as the presidential candidate ahead of the November general election.
Before you, ladies and gentlemen, is the largest haul of ivory and horn ever to be destroyed in this manner. And our reason is crystal clear.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta sets fire to the country's seized ivory stockpile.
We believe that as the ZCTU, we now have a constitution of the country, and we now believe that it is our right as ZCTU to demand and protect the rights of workers.
And it's Labor Day today in many parts of the world, but most Zimbabwean workers in the southeastern city of Mazvingo say they face poor working conditions. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Ghanaian opposition National Democratic Party, or NDP, has elected former First Lady Nana Kunedu Ajiman Rawlings as its presidential candidate at the party's National Delegates Congress at the trade fair site in the capital Accra on Saturday. Supporters of the NDP say the popularity of the former First Lady could pose a significant challenge to incumbent President John Dramani Mahama in the November 7 general election. Mohamed Frimpong, general secretary of the party, told me that Ajiman Rawlings is the best candidate to deliver the change Ghanaians demand.
The entire country is clamoring for her return onto the political landscape to give to Ghanaians what she had done and knows best in terms of mobilization, women empowerment, and so on and so forth. That is how the NDP followers throughout the country had unanimously decided to endorse her as our presidential candidate for the 2016 election.
She has also been congratulated by main opposition leader Nana Addo-Dankwa Akufo-Addo. Some people are speculating that there could be an alliance of her, the NDP, and the NPP ahead of the election. What can you tell me about this speculation?
Well, alliance ahead of the election is not in our agenda. That I can tell you for sure. But the point is that we are all bent on seeking change. There's a very strong determination for change. That one is consolidated, that determination. And that is why probably the MPP flag bearer and our just endorsed flag bearer will share this common opinion for the need of change.
Some Ghanaians that I have spoken with say that Nana Kunedu Ajiman Rawlings did not perform particularly well in the last election. What is going to be different this time?
We had very strong detractors in the 2012 election. And just as we were preparing to file her flag bearership with the Electoral Commission, there was a very elaborate conspiracy to scuttle this attempt. And that is what happened. We could not file her candidature with Electoral Commission. And therefore, nobody could base her performance or would-be performance on the 2012 election because, after all, she didn't participate.
Josiah, a prominent member, a leading member of the NDP, I'm told, was sidelined ahead of the Congress and other members as well. Speculation is that not everything is well in the NDP as a party, and that is why they are saying it remains to be seen if the NDP can pose any significant challenge at all.
The issue of Dr. Josiah Ayer is one of indisposition. He is indisposed and would definitely not be available for the hectic season, political season for the 2016 election, and that is why he had step aside for another national chairman who had already been elected to take up that role. So that is it. There are no other prominent members that we know who have been sidelined. I don't think there are any.
What do you think the chances are for Nana Kunedu Ajiman Rawlings in this year's presidential election?
Thank you very much. Going into 2016, we can project two key figures as having the highest visibility on their own respective accounts. First of all, Nana Kunedu Ajiman Rawlings cuts across all generations of you know, our body politic, and two, she is a female contestant, and is becoming quite prominent. That Ghanaians think, you know, a female must be given a chance, and the record of probity and accountability in governance was picked very, very high in their tenure and has slumped now to a very abysmal level, you know. And just like I've said, everybody look up to her and her spouse that seriously, I mean, constitutional efficiency and sanity will very much, you know, characterize their personalities. And therefore, with all these considerations, coupled with her drive towards mobilization to eliminate poverty and disease and literacy. I mean, all these go to create fond memories in the population, particularly the older generation and the younger ones as well, who have known her or had her commended highly by their parents. You know, these facts are very real. And that makes her very, very, very prominent, you know, and more visible as far as the 2016 elections are concerned. And therefore, comparing with the three other flag bearers, that's the incumbent and then the biggest opposition party, Nana Addo Dankwa, we can say that it will be very, very difficult just to think that there can just be a one round of. And this definitely is going to be a factor by the NDP flag bearer, Nana Kunedu Ajiman Rawlings.
Mohammed Frimpong is the General Secretary of the Ghanaian Opposition National Democratic Party, or NDP. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. The Giants Club Summit in Kenya focused on what African countries can do to stop elephant poaching, but that is only half the battle. For VOA, Lenny Ruvaga spoke to the Asia representative of the World Wildlife Fund about what must be done to stop demand and international trafficking in ivory.
Rain pounded the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, for close to 3 hours Saturday. However, it did not dampen the mood of conservationists and international organizations that had gathered to witness one of the largest ivory burns on the African continent. At around 3 p.m. East African time, 105 tons of ivory stacked up in 11 pyres was lit up in a symbolic move by Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta and Gabon's President Ali Bongo Ondimo. The tusks from 8,500 elephants marked the culmination of a call by African leaders, including Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni, to end the illegal trade in ivory. Conservationists were torn on which side of the debate to cast their weight. However, those in support of the ban expressed support only if it would end the trade in illegal ivory. Jean-Pai Ongsewiritaya, the policy advocacy specialist in Asia for the WWF, noted that the organization stood in solidarity of the burn only if it would curb the trade.
The only reason that we support the burning or the destruction of the ivory stockpile, it's only if the government keep use this as an opportunity to send to the public, send to the criminals that they are serious and has zero tolerance to the illegal ivory trade, to the poaching of elephants, That is the only reason why we're supporting it.
Last August, Thailand destroyed over 2 tons of elephant tusks, carved ivory and trinkets, most of it from elephants poached from the African continent. Thailand passed several new regulations in an effort to shut down its national ivory market. The government also made African elephants a protected species and further co-sponsored a historic United Nations General Assembly resolution to address illegal wildlife trade. A WWF campaign dubbed Cho Changru last January condemned the killing of elephants for ivory by symbolically removing the letter Cho Chang from their names. The Thai word for elephant is Chang, and it starts with a letter in the Thai alphabet called Chor. When learning the alphabet or spelling words with this symbol, it's referred to as Cho Chang, and it is a common letter in the Thai alphabet similar to E for elephant. Speaking to VOA, Ong Siriwitaya pointed out that the country has passed a number of laws to crack down on the illegal ivory trade. But the biggest asset, according to her, is public support.
First, we're advocating with the public to understand the issues of illegal ivory trade as a transnational crime. Both it's similar to drugs, similar to illicit arms that coming across African continent, passing through Asia and coming to Thailand, both as a transit and as the end destination.
Asia has been the largest destination for ivory from around the world, with the Kenyan port of Mombasa being a key transit point. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Meanwhile, to send a message to the world that ivory is worth more on an elephant than it is in the market, Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta set fire to the country's ivory stockpile Saturday, making it the largest ivory burn in history. VOA's Jill Craig attended the event and has this report from Nairobi.
Plumes of smoke filled the air of a muddy Nairobi National Park as Kenya's President Kenyatta presided over the burning of 105 tons of elephant ivory as well as 1.35 tons of rhino horn.
The height of the pile of ivory before us marks the strength of our resolve. Before you, ladies and gentlemen, is the largest haul of ivory and horn ever to be destroyed in this manner. And our reason is crystal clear. No one, and I repeat again, no one has any business trading in ivory, for this trade means death, death of our elephants, and death of our natural heritage.
The event marked Kenya's commitment to stopping the poaching epidemic, which has resulted in tens of thousands of elephants across the continent being killed every year for their ivory tusks. In total, the ivory at the burn represented tusks from an estimated 8,500 elephants, according to a Kenya Wildlife Service spokesman Saturday. Critics have argued that poor countries like Kenya should sell the ivory to improve the lives of their people. The Kenya Wildlife Service has responded that selling these illegal trophies dramatically increases elephant poaching, threatening the animal's very existence. Living elephants have value, whereas ivory does not. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State for Management and Resources Heather Higginbottom attended the event and said that saving elephants helps everyone.
There are economic benefits to tourism, to ecotourism, and that provides jobs and stability. It ensures that there is going to be more and more demand to see these amazing creatures. That helps the people of Kenya as well as the habitat and the animals.
Poaching has escalated to alarming heights in recent years, as 100,000 African elephants were killed between 2010 and 2012. International Fund for Animal Welfare East Africa Regional Director James Asiche says these numbers represent a grave threat to elephants everywhere.
If it continues, if the killing continues as it is now, then we cannot sustain the elephant populations in the next 20 years.
Kenya has had success in reducing poaching from 384 elephants killed in 2012 to 96 killed in 2015. But conservationists say that this progress could quickly be reversed if people don't remain diligent. But if they do, then Peter Knights, CEO of the wildlife conservation group WildAid, might be right about Kenya's 2016 ivory burn.
Well, I think we might look back historically, and this might be the image which represents the end of the ivory trade, we hope.
President Kenyatta says he is seeking a total ban on the ivory trade at the CITES International Wildlife Trade Meeting, which will take place this September. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Most workers in Zimbabwe's southeastern city of Mazvingo say they are facing deteriorating working conditions, getting low salaries, and generally struggling to make ends meet. This, they say, is due to a depressed local economy, which has resulted in low production in many companies. The workers also say, as a result, Labor Day has become an ordinary event, since they are doing what they call non-rewarding formal and informal jobs. For VOA, Gandhi Maramba reports from Mazvingo.
One of the most discounted workers is Sheila Gakava, an employee of the local branch of the National Railways of Zimbabwe, who says there's nothing to celebrate on Labor Day.
In the past, this used to be an important day in my life, but not anymore. I have not been paid for 7 months, and I can't fend for my family. My children are dropping out of school, and so to say I'm celebrating May Day, to me, does not make sense. I'm working, but I have nothing. Like in Zimbabwe, yes, we are going to work, but working for what? It's working for nothing. We are getting peanuts.
Another local worker, Zakaria Chikwenya, says most employees are working for nothing.
There's nothing much to celebrate. We are having economic hardships. Employees haven't been paid for a very long time in this country. Obviously, we'll be celebrating our poverty, hoping maybe we'll achieve something in the future. It's only hope that is keeping us alive. We don't think that we have a solution as of now, but hope maybe things change in the future. Maybe we have a better future as workers.
Zimbabwe's largest workers' representative body, the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions, or ZCTU, says although the labor situation is bad in the country, it is going ahead with national preparations for Labor Day. Michael Kandukutu, ZCTU National Organizing Director, says preparations are at an advanced stage for marking the Labor Day.
The Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions is going to be commemorating Workers' Day in 30 centers of our various regions that we have. Our structures and our members in the respective centers are busy fundraising and also busy organizing and mobilizing for workers to be able to attend this day. This day, we are commemorating it under the theme Defending Workers' Constitutional Rights, Our Prerogative. We believe that as the ZCTU, we now have a constitution of the country, and we now believe that it is our right as ZCTU to demand and protect the rights of workers that they have in terms of the constitution. These rights vary from the right to land, which is very cardinal, the right to work, labor rights as enshrined by the constitution, the right to an environment. So we are saying that the constitution becomes our rallying point as ZCTU.
ZCTU bemoaned the violations of workers' rights in the country and the general decay of the economy, which it says is contributing towards the impoverishment and suffering of workers. ZCTU Gender Director Fiona Magaya says women are facing serious challenges and violations of their rights and continue to suffer more despite their rights being enshrined in Zimbabwe's constitution.
Most of our male counterparts believe that women are not good leaders, believe that women belong in the kitchen. But actually, women are and can be good leaders if given the opportunity and if given the skill. And in the workplace, there's a lot of sexual harassment. Some people that are in authority, they request sexual favors as a condition for you to go up the ladder. And that is a serious violation of our rights as women. And even if we look into the political arena, you find that the issues that have been well dealt with in the law or in our policies to achieve gender equality are not being enforced, even in the parliament. For example, we claim to have a 60 seats that are strictly reserved for women. But in reality, how many women are in parliament? And in reality, how many women ministers, authentic ministers, not deputies, are there in parliament? So you find that sometimes we speak about things, but we don't actually put them into practice.
Kandukutu says workers in Zimbabwe are facing a number of challenges.
Well, looking at the commemoration of Workers' Day, in the past it used to be a celebration, but not anymore, because the workers in Zimbabwe currently have been faced by a number of challenges, particularly some of them emanating from the July 17 Supreme Court ruling, where we saw about 28,000 of workers being laid off. Some of those workers are yet to be reinstated by the employers, because the employers have actually even gone to court to challenge the retrospectivity element of the Labour Amendment Act number 5. So it's a battle that we still have. Workers are now faced with serious situations of non-payment of salaries. We have workers that have gone on a record 77 months with no salaries, but the government and the employers expect those workers to be surviving. So non-payment becomes an issue. We are also faced with a challenge where our government, the ministers, are promoting labor market flexibility, where they are bringing in this concept that the employer can hire and fire labor as they wish, which is putting us back to the days of 1890, when the British South Africa Company and Cecil John Rhodes came to invade this country of ours. The battle is on, the fight continues, the struggle continues. That is why we are rallying behind our call, Shinga Mshandi Shinga.
Zimbabwe has declared the first day of May a national holiday to give workers a chance to commemorate Labour Day, but employees say the holiday has lost meaning. This is Gandhi Maramba.
Meanwhile, Zimbabwean women who were stranded in Kuwait, where they expected to get high-paying jobs, are set to leave and arrive in Harare. This after they were allegedly abused by their Kuwaiti employers. The 32 are part of a group of 200 women and girls who were trafficked to Kuwait, where they were promised great jobs, only to be turned into prostitutes by their employers. Reporter Marvelous Mlanga Nyauye spoke with lawmaker Kindness Paraja, who was part of a parliamentary delegation visiting the country on a House of Assembly mission.
I'm in Kuwait together with my delegation, which includes Chief Msarurwa, and we are right now organizing the departure of all our 32 girls. All the tickets are now in place, and we should be departing for Dubai before proceeding to Harare.
Honorable Paraza, what happens to the parents that have some of their children who are part of these 32? When do they get to meet their children?
When we arrive tomorrow in Harare, the Speaker of the National Assembly will hand over all these girls to Minister of Public Service, Social Welfare, Honorable Mfulira, and also Minister of Health, Dr. Parerinyatwa, because we need a medical team to be in place, and we also need the counselors to be in place, and these girls are going to be taken to a government safe house so that they can debrief even our security sector as well about what has been happening to them here.
So for the parents who are anxious to meet their children, are they allowed to come to the airport, or what's the procedure?
We welcome the parents to the airport. We welcome also other women to the airport to come and welcome these girls. We welcome the parents. They must come to the airport, the parents, for the 32 girls. And we've identified other 5 as well who will be coming later, possibly next week, and we are doing the processes as well. But I must also point out that there are about 5 girls who are Zimbabwean, who are here, who are working in cahoots with a syndicate, which is here. And they are sending WhatsApp pictures to our girls in Harare, telling them that there is luxury here in Kuwait, there is money here in Kuwait. So they must never, never allow themselves to be tricked that way.
Kindness Paradza is a Zimbabwean lawmaker. He spoke with Marvelous Mlanga Nyahuye from Kuwait.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. We'll discuss Burundi's violence and security. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Good evening, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with football. In London, Leicester City, a pro soccer team built on a shoestring budget and hailing from an unfashionable city in central London, came close to clinching the British Premier League Sunday with a 1-1 draw with 13-time champions Manchester United. Leicester was never supposed to be a contender for one of the most prestigious competitions in the soccer world. The Premier League is the most watched domestic soccer competition on the planet, with a total of 4.7 billion global TV viewers last year. A television deal worth $7.75 billion will kick in next year to be shared among the clubs depending on where they rank. Now, Leicester needs only 2 points to make sure they clinch the title as players return to the King Power Stadium, their home turf, on May 7th to play Everton. But they will be champions if Tottenham do not win at Chelsea on Monday night. Still in London, Jemina Samgong claimed elite women gold at the Virgin Money London Marathon last Sunday, despite falling and crushing her head against the tarmac in the later stages. The Kenyan incredibly recovered from the fall, which occurred as runners bundled to get to a water station to claim a 5-second victory over 2015 winner Tigist Tufa. Her victory means that Kenyans have won the women's main race in 5 of the past 6 years. In this post-race interview with the energetic Andy Edwards, Samgong talks about her recovery from the fall, her Kalenjin fighting spirit, and the Olympics.
Jemima, when something like that goes wrong in a race, how do you recover? Is it a case of all those years of training and determination that you call upon? Because, let's face it, some runners might have said, oh, well, I'm hurt, I'm giving up, but you didn't.
No. That cannot make us to lose the spirit of winning. That's first thing, it was a challenge. So in Kenya, back home, we have different tribes. My tribe is Kalenjin. So first thing, when you get a challenge, that means there is a successful in front of you. So we just believe when you get a challenge, there is a successful in front of you. So when I just punk my head, that was first challenge. And I knew this is now a belief that I'm going to win. Also, it's a matter of training. Back home, Kenya, we can go through hardships through training. So someone can fall down, wake up, and go. So it's just a matter of, it's normal.
That sounds like a mix of course, you've got to do the training. There's no point, if you're not fit, just saying, I'm going to do this. But also a kind of cultural belief. I mean, to be honest, I've heard it said sometimes, somebody who's a Kalenjin who is unfit and then starts to run and then discovers they have great talent, and then somebody else says, oh, well, that's because you're a Kalenjin. You're a good runner because all Kalenjins are good runners. But am I wrong in suggesting that?
No. Oh, I can say not even a tribal like Kalenjins, when they get a challenge, it's a belief that you will win alone. No matter the training you have taken, always when you are coming to a race, you are well prepared from mine, heart, and even physically, you are well fit. So why don't you race and win?
Well, you certainly did that. What about the future? Of course, we're waiting eagerly for news of the Kenyan Olympic marathon selection. But let's assume that you are picked for that Olympic marathon in Rio. Would you think of preparing any differently to how you've prepared for London? And indeed, you're an experienced marathon runner. You've had very consistent results, but this was your first big win. Would you change your preparation because it's an Olympic marathon?
No. I will not change because Olympic is also a major marathon like this one of London. So I must go with what I must go with what I did so that I can excel like the way I excel in London.
Could there even be a danger for some people, if they're selected for the Olympic marathon, they think they have to train harder? They put in more effort because, you know, looking over the years, I've been covering track and field for 30-odd years, you get some people who say, oh, it's the Olympics, I'm going to train harder than ever before. And sometimes they get ill, they get injured because they get distracted.
Yeah, usually when you get a challenge, when you are being selected, it's not a matter of you are going now to put more effort so that you can do it well. No. Just do the way the program is. Do the way your body responds. Do what you are doing. Do not change anything because you can make it be worse. You can get injuries. You can be permanently, or you can even lose going to Rio because of changing the program.
Well, Jemima Songok, let's hope you bring that Kalenjin spirit and all your training to that Olympic marathon in Rio. Thank you.
Thank you very much. See you next time.
And finally, the World Football Governing Body, FIFA, has appointed a normalization committee to take charge of Guinea's Football Federation, FGF. FIFA acted following the internal wrangles affecting the FGF that have halted all football competitions in Guinea. The committee, whose members will be selected by FIFA and the Confederation of African Football, will be tasked to organize FGF elections by February 28th next year. Until then, the committee will run the daily affairs of FGF. The problems have affected Guinea's campaign to qualify for next year's Africa Cup of Nations tournament. They are third in their group behind Zimbabwe and Swaziland, with only the winners guaranteed a place at the finals in Gabon. Guinea are also due to host the 2023 Africa Cup of Nations, a decision that was made by CAF in 2014. And that's it for this edition of Netline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
On danse mon coupé décalé, oh, Beno.
Sing it.
Africa,
aye,
moi je t'aime,
abilo dilo.
L'amour est,
aye,
moi j'adore,
abilo dilo.
Les femmes,
aye,
je vous aime,
abilo dilo.
Bisous,
aye,
à tous mes femmes,
abilo dilo. Sing it.
Beno, mon coupé décalé.
mabringe. Makaba bereke. Mabringa mabringe. Yeah, makaba bereke. Mabringa mabringe. Motre mon comment tu danses? Motre mon comment tu bouges? Ma chérie, faut pas me toucher. Sinon yaka 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 ya. Ayaka yaka yaka ya. Ayaka yaka yaka ya. Ayaka yaka 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 yaka.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. South Africa's president, Jacob Zuma, is yet again under a serious cloud of political corruption. Last week, a court reinstated an earlier charge of corruption against President Zuma, which had been set aside by another court. Some South Africans believe that this decision of the court would allow President Zuma to have his day in court as he had earlier demanded. Thus far, majority of South Africans regard the judiciary and the courts as independent and contributing favorably to constitutional government in South Africa. But we should not ignore the fact that there is a small minority in South Africa that are worried about what they perceive as excessive activism of the courts, particularly as it may relate to political matters. And this grumbling is not only among some ANC members, but among some serious legal and political scholars. And one should not say that because South Africa is a young African democracy, that it should have been expected that people will start questioning the independence of the courts. Let us also not forget that the ANC government, when it won majority rule election in 1994, has never tampered with the courts, even though most of its members were members of the court under the apartheid regime. It should also be borne in mind that mature democracies also have questions about too active court system. In the United States, during the presidency of President Delano Roosevelt, he was very much concerned that the Supreme Court was tampering or opposing his legislative programs. He was so concerned that he toyed with the idea of packing the Supreme Court. Even as we go through the primary elections in the United States, the independence or balance of the court is at the forefront. When a most extreme conservative died recently and President Obama appointed a new nominee, the Republican Party has refused to consider that nomination and appoint a new Supreme Court judge, even though the courts now remain split for liberal and conservatives. Now, we should also bear in mind that at the present time, a ruling by the Supreme Court of the United States called Citizens United has been challenged by many candidates who believe that that ruling by the Supreme Court brought in too much money in the political campaign in the United States. Similar examples could be found in other mature democracies. What is being suggested is that when courts become too active and make rulings that affect political balance, one is bound to have some kind of criticism from the political class. And this is what may happen in South Africa. Those who are worried about the frequent ruling by the courts in South Africa on political matters now suspect that the Democratic Alliance, the main opposition party, having failed to win elections in the polls, may want to use South Africa's courts to gain political advantage. If this is the case, it will be a very serious matter and detrimental to democratic development in South Africa. So the courts in South Africa should be wary of how far they would go in such rulings. Of course, no one says that the South African president or any major political figure should be above the law. In democracy, no one is above the law. But legal scholars have always talked about judicial conservatism, and it is important for South African democracy that two things happen. One, the South African opposition should be wary of frequent approach to the courts to make difficult political decisions. Secondly, the courts also should observe judicial conservatism in not always jumping into serious political problems. Because if this minority rumbling becomes a majority within the country and there is tendency to criticize the courts in South Africa, this will not be to the favor of a democratic South Africa. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a child does not fear treading on dangerous grounds until he or she gets hurt. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It is not a great time to be an ISIL fighter. Because of the intensified efforts of the counter-ISIL coalition, ISIL, also known as Daesh fighters, are facing pay cuts, a shortage of manpower, a decrease in perks, like using vehicles for personal use, and, more importantly, a shortage of medical expertise, as doctors reportedly flee ISIL-held territory. Now they face a new worry. President Barack Obama approved additional support for Iraqi forces fighting ISIL. On April 25th, President Obama also announced increased support for local forces fighting in Syria.
A small number of American special operations forces are already on the ground in Syria, and their expertise has been critical as local forces have driven ISIL out of key areas. So given the success, I've approved the deployment of up to 250 additional U.S. personnel in Syria, including special forces, to keep up this momentum.
The additional U.S. forces will not be leading the fight on the ground. Instead, they will be assisting and advising indigenous counter-ISIL fighters, including Kurdish, Arab, and other Syrian forces, said State Department spokesperson John Kirby.
Our goal is to provide advice and assistance to all those who can effectively go after Daesh.
At a press briefing, U.S. Air Force Major General Peter Gersten, the U.S.-led coalition's deputy commander for operations and intelligence, said that ISIL's morale is beginning to deteriorate at a fairly increasing rate, adding that fighters have been trying to defect, at times claiming to be refugees and even disguising themselves as women. That's the kind of cowardice we're dealing with. Major General Gersten emphasized, however, that this enemy is a persistent cancer. If left unchecked, it will continue to metastasize and significantly infect the world. Right now, he said, we've got them in a position that they cannot maneuver on the battle space in an effective way. But, he added, we also must understand that this fight requires both patience and time.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.